for some reason, our own immune system that normally fights infections can turn on us and destroy our organs. One organ that gets picked off is the pancreas, and that produces insulin. Now, unlike type 2 diabetes, people with type 1 diabetes will then require insulin injections for the rest of their lives, and their glucose levels can fluctuate wildly. So what's the best diet? And is it possible to smooth those blood sugars out? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello and welcome to Go Healthy for Good. If you want to know how type 1 diabetes is diagnosed, listen to Cyrus as he shares his diagnostic journey. His initial symptoms were classic. Watch.
So I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 22. It was my senior year of college and I was just trying to graduate and move on with my life. And there was about a two-week period where I felt real bad. So I noticed that I was very thirsty. I was drinking a gallon, maybe sometimes a gallon and a half of water per day. And I was urinating about 18, 19, 20 times per day, literally every 30 minutes, just like around the clock. And I lost a lot of energy. So I would eat a plate of food and then I would just fall asleep at the table. And so I picked up the phone and I called my sister. My sister is a doctor of osteopathy and she is very smart. So I explained my symptomology to her and she started crying immediately. She said, "Cyrus, you have type 1 diabetes. Please go to the hospital right now." And I looked at her and I was like, I don't have type 1 diabetes. And she's like, "I don't have time to explain, but you do. Go get that checked out right now." Now at the time, I didn't know anything about biology. All I knew was that diabetes had something to do with old people and with cake. And that clearly didn't describe me. So when I went to the hospital, they checked my blood glucose and it was 600 and beyond. And that was six times higher than it was supposed to be. And so this is my first entrance into anything related to diabetes. So after 24 hours, they discharged me with a prescription for insulin, two different types of insulin, a blood glucose meter, test strips, a carbohydrate counting guide, and a lot of fear. And I went back to my normal daily life, having to inject insulin every single time I ate food, not knowing what I could eat, still feeling low energy, not knowing how to exercise, and it was this, like my whole life had been disrupted. So for the first year, I was following the doctor's advice when it came to nutrition, and they said eat a low carbohydrate diet because that's the only way that you can minimize your blood glucose and you can control your glucose with precision. So I said, fine, I'll eat more meat, chicken, fish, peanut butter, dairy products. I love that stuff, I'm gonna do it anyway. So I started eating those foods and a lot more of them, and I started restricting my carbohydrate-rich food intake, like rice and pasta and fruits and potatoes. I wasn't eating those foods very much. And I thought that it was supposed to make me feel better and it was supposed to improve my quality of life, but it did the exact opposite. I felt terrible. I had less energy. I couldn't digest food properly. My muscles started to hurt. My joints started to hurt. I couldn't exercise. And the worst part about it was that my blood glucose was a nightmare. An absolute nightmare. It was just this roller coaster all day long. So after about a year, I decided that I had to change. And I started doing research and talking to people and watching scientific lectures, and one thing led to another. And this idea of adopting a plant-based diet first got planted in my head at that time. And I said, you know what? I don't want to be a vegetarian. I don't want to be a vegan. I just want to feel better. But I'm willing to try anything that's going to make me actually improve my health.
Being desperate to feel better can be the greatest motivator. We'll hear a lot more from Cyrus today because he is also our expert guest as we discuss type 1 diabetes. Sean's going to coach us with some great new exercises and Chef Mark Anthony has a delicious hot breakfast waiting. But first, the news. In the headlines today, type 1 diabetes in hamsters, move away from fast food, and plants for diabetes. Parents who keep a pet hamster during pregnancy may increase the risk of type 1 diabetes in their child. Different viruses may contribute to the development of type 1 diabetes even in pregnancy. Animals can host viruses and pass them on to humans. So Swedish researchers wanted to know if exposure to pets during pregnancy changed the risk. They studied 16,000 parents and found that while dogs and cats made no difference, a pet hamster may increase the risk fourfold. However, since only 150 families in their study kept hamsters, more research is needed to be sure it was not just a coincidence. Having high-calorie, low-nutrient takeaways or fast food outlets close to home appears to significantly increase the risk of diabetes. A recent study assessed 350,000 adults from across the UK and measured the distance from their home to junk food venues where foods rich in fat, salt and sugar and other unhealthy ingredients were sold. Those living less than half a mile away from the ready-to-eat food venues were 11% more likely to develop type 2 diabetes than those living further away. The association was greater for women and those who were already overweight. If you live near a place that tempts you to buy convenience foods, keep your fridge full of healthy, delicious home-cooked meals. A plant-based diet may help boost the physical and mental health of people with type 2 diabetes. Diabetics who switched to a plant-based diet tended to have better blood sugar, lipid and cholesterol levels according to data collected from 433 participants in 11 different clinical trials. They experienced significant relief from diabetes-related nerve pain, suggesting a slowing of diabetes-related nerve damage. In half of the studies, patients were able to reduce or stop medications. Their mood lifted, depression dropped, and overall quality of life improved. A separate study of 75 individuals were randomized to either their usual diet or a plant-based, high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet for 4 months. Those on the vegan diet lost an average of 14 pounds in weight, with a reduction in body fat mass and an improvement in insulin sensitivity. The benefits are undeniable. If you have type 2 diabetes, make the switch to a plant-based diet today. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Today's guest is Dr. Cyrus Kambata, nutritional and fitness coach who has the inside scoop on type 1 diabetes. He was a presenter at the American College of Lifestyle Medicine meeting in Indianapolis, where we caught up with him. I asked him to explain autoimmune diabetes.
So autoimmune diabetes refers to type 1 or type 1.5 diabetes, where your own immune system has mistakenly targeted your insulin-producing beta cells for destruction, therefore rendering your ability to secrete insulin. It starts out at a reasonable amount of physiological insulin production, and then it decreases over time. And people with autoimmune diabetes generally progress to full insulin dependence over the span of about 6 months to 18 months.
And so for our viewers, explain how that is different to type 2 diabetes, because that's the more common, much more common type.
That's exactly right. So pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes affects 90%+ of the diabetes population, and then the other 8 to 10% of the population has autoimmune type 1 or type 1.5 diabetes. Now the difference, the major difference between the two of those is that autoimmune diabetes is an immune regulated process. So your immune system has mistakenly targeted those cells for destruction. But in pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes, there's no immune system involvement in the sense that it's a lifestyle condition. Meaning that over the course of time, as you've eaten a diet that's either incredibly high in fat, high in sugar, high in both, high in processed and packaged foods, combined with a sedentary lifestyle, it sets the stage for a collection of metabolic dysfunctions, which then result in high blood glucose, high insulin production, and then therefore the transition to pre-diabetes, which it can eventually progress to type 2 diabetes.
So quite different mechanism, and it takes years, right? Whereas your autoimmune is, you're talking months.
Yeah, it's actually a really good question, because pre-diabetes is the sort of infant state of type 2 diabetes. It's like the warning sign where you go to your doctor and you see that your blood glucose is starting to get elevated, and at that point you can make a decision about changing your lifestyle to move back into a non-diabetic state. It turns out that when you develop the symptoms of prediabetes, you can be living with the baseline condition, which is called insulin resistance. You can be living with insulin resistance for as little as 1 year or as many as 20 years. So there's actually some really compelling evidence-based research which shows that, you know, insulin resistance is this silent condition. You and I would never know that it's even there until you go to the doctor and you see that your blood glucose is elevated. And then, over the course of time, that can progress to type 2 diabetes. But in the case of autoimmune diabetes, it's a sudden onset in the sense that you can go from feeling normal today to literally 2 days later, you feel terrible. You feel terrible, you're thirsty all the time, you're urinating frequently, you have no energy, you might be losing weight rapidly. And at that point, you go to the doctor, and generally, the doctor will take your blood glucose and they'll find that your blood glucose is very high. And you'll say to yourself, well, I was okay 2 days ago, and in reality, you felt fine. But there's a whole bunch of redundant mechanisms inside of your brain, your liver, your kidney, your heart, your pancreas, your liver, you name it. And those redundant mechanisms make it so that you feel fine. But in reality, the autoimmune process has been developing over the course of months to even years.
We will dive into the best diet to deal with type 1 diabetes in the next segment, so stay with us. Before the break, however, check this out.
Hey, why didn't you join me and sing with me?
Well, I was waiting for you to hit the right note, but you didn't.
Yeah, well, I know I'm pretty bad. You know, even though I don't have perfect pitch, I really do enjoy playing the guitar and singing.
You shouldn't worry about the perfect pitch. You know, music is about expressing yourself and enjoyment. Do you know it's linked to cognitive improvement? And for little ones, they improve their language development, and it's good for social interaction.
You know, in parts of the brain, the two halves function separately. The left brain is analytical and the right brain is artistic. Performing or listening to music impacts both the brain as a whole. Therefore, it stimulates both halves.
Yeah, and I guess maybe Einstein's mother knew that, because when she was told that Albert was not very bright, she enrolled him in violin lessons, and pretty soon she had a genius on her hands. And you know, it's just a really beautiful example of how a child's intellectual capacity can be opened up by music.
So is all music good for you?
Well, that's a whole different topic, but let's just say for now that the music that you're playing and singing is good for you.
You know, even though I'm out of tune, do you mind if I go ahead and play and sing?
I think you should. Doctor's orders.
Thank you, Doc.
We're in the kitchen with Chef Mark Anthony, and something is smelling wonderful right now. Mark, what are you up to?
Waffles! It's a waffle day!
It's waffles!
Yes, and I made it easy. I made it easy for people to do waffles, and anybody can enjoy these because they're also gluten-free.
Serious?
Yes. I actually make them with oats.
So what else goes in them?
Well, here's the recipe right here. We've actually got 6 cups of soy milk and 6 cups of oats, and you can use the regular oats or the quick oats. We've got 1/4 cup of ground flaxseed, 1/4 cup of honey, 1 tablespoon of vanilla, 1 tablespoon of salt, and 1 tablespoon of cinnamon. Equal parts of oats and liquid. You mix them together and you can flavor it any way you want.
So you could take 3 cups and 3 cups or
6 cups and 6 cups.
Yep, right.
And as long as the liquid equals the actual oats, you're going to have it. Here's the other nice part about it. Let me check and see if this one's done yet. It's got about half a minute.
Smelling so good.
Because you could actually take equal parts of oats and orange juice or pineapple juice, or you can make, there's just hundreds and hundreds of different variations. Okay,
wow.
We're good. Let me share this with you. Grab that plate over there, and we're going to see if I can get this out of here. This one's been going for a few minutes here already, and there you go.
He's got just chef's like hands. Did you see that?
Yeah, don't try this at home.
Yeah.
I'm going to give this a little spray. I didn't spray it on the last one. But let me share with you what we're going to do here, because this is the, see how thick
batter.
It is?
Yep.
And that's about the thickness you're looking for. And if you let it set a little while, sometimes it'll thicken up even more.
Yep.
Then you just add a little more liquid to it.
Yep.
And then you're just going to pour this in here.
You can just sort of wait until, if you've got a vortex, you're about right. If it's a vortex that goes all the way to the blade, it's a bit thin, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep. And so you can see how I kind of just barely get to the outside there. Do this, give it a flip. I like these type of waffle irons because it really gets those deep pockets.
So you better pause into your grooves.
But you can decorate it any way you want. I've got a whole bunch of ingredients there for you to decorate.
Are we going to go whipped cream and chocolate chip, or are we going to go berries?
Berries
for our eyes, right?
Go ahead. You can do it.
And then you can use oats that are gluten-free, or oats don't contain gluten, but they're often contaminated. So
it all depends. The processing factory sometimes will work the same type of thing in wheat. What we will do is freeze these.
Okay.
But what you have to do is you have to freeze them individually. And I'll take a sheet pan and then just freeze individual quick freeze, IQF. And then after they're frozen, then you can bag them together like this and see how they're still separated. Because if you take them like this and then just take them right in a baggie, which a lot of people do that, and they just kind of melt together, and then you have a lot of difficulty trying to pull them apart. So you just freeze them first, individual quick freeze, and then you can pull these out and cut them, put them right in the toaster, and in
minutes. That's what I love about this. When I have gluten-free patients, and they go, oh, I miss my bread. You don't need to miss your bread. You can make waffles.
Yeah, and this one is even out of oats. So
I've got to try this. I've got to try this. Are you indulging? No.
I'm all for it.
You can have the chocolate chip and whipped cream.
Like I said, the flavor.
That's so crunchy and yummy.
My wife made the topping. That's
it's so good. I just love that.
But as far as the waffles go, the flavor is where it's at. So if you want to go with this is more of the traditional, you know, vanilla and cinnamon. You can also do peanut butter and different. I mean, you can really get crazy with variations just once you know the equal parts.
You can put peanut butter in your waffles?
Yes. I mean, there's so many things you can do.
Who would know?
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Mark. That's
there we go.
Great breakfast.
Easy.
Remember that if you missed writing down all those ingredients, you can find our recipes on our website. Cyrus was found to have type 1 diabetes at 22 years of age. He was told to eat a low-carb diet. That made him feel very unwell. His blood sugars were uncontrolled, and he hurt so bad he couldn't play sport anymore, which he loved. He decided he had to try something different. Watch.
Not only did I have type 1 diabetes as an autoimmune condition, but that I actually had two other autoimmune conditions. Now, the first autoimmune condition is called Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, which I had been diagnosed with 6 months prior. And then the second one is called alopecia universalis. And that's why I have no hair, I have no eyebrows, I have no eyelashes, I have no armpit hair, I have no chest hair. I am a hairless being. So I lost all my hair over the span of a couple of months. And it turns out that's the second autoimmune condition. And then the third autoimmune condition was type 1 diabetes. So I went to a health retreat, and under the supervision of a nutrition guru named Dr. Doug Graham, he showed me how I could switch over to eating a low-fat, plant-based, whole food diet with lots of fruits and lots of vegetables. And within 24 hours, my blood glucose started falling rapidly. And as a result of that, I had to start decreasing my insulin use. But the funny thing was that I was eating more carbohydrate energy. So here I am now eating more carbohydrate energy and using less insulin. And the more carbohydrate energy I ate, the less insulin I used. So this process kept on continuing. And over the span of the first 3 months, I had increased my carbohydrate intake by 5 or 6 fold, and I had decreased my insulin use by 40%. So I knew that there was something fascinating happening inside of this experiment. I just didn't know how to explain it. So I put myself back to school, and I went and I got a PhD in nutritional biochemistry. And while I was studying the cellular mechanisms of diabetes, of insulin resistance, of what causes prediabetes, what causes autoimmunity, I started to recognize that there was more than 85 years of research, of evidence-based research, in support of low-fat, plant-based, whole food nutrition that had been conducted, and put into a vault somewhere. And very few people knew about this. And even in the world even in the scientific world, people were not talking about this information. So I pulled all this information out, and I started to read it, and it started to validate and give physiological descriptions for everything that was happening inside of me. And at that point, a light bulb went off, and I said, you know what? Not only can this describe what happened inside of me, this describes what happens inside of people living with prediabetes and with type 2 diabetes. All of this makes perfect sense. And so this was a real good opportunity for me to be able to scientifically explain what was happening, and then to create a program that actually can help other people who are living with either type 1 diabetes, type 1.5, pre-diabetes, type 2 diabetes, or gestational diabetes. And so this idea of Mastering Diabetes was then born.
Mastering Diabetes is the coaching company that he and business partner Robbie co-founded to help others who have diabetes.
I would recommend the same dietary advice for people living with autoimmune diabetes as I would for people who are living with lifestyle diabetes. And the reason for that is because, you know, we've heard the story before that if you're living with prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, if you adopt a whole food plant-based diet, and in fact a low-fat plant-based whole food diet, that's when you can see tremendous improvements in your diabetes health. Your blood glucose can come down very quickly. Your insulin production can come down very quickly. Your fasting glucose comes down. Your post-meal blood glucose comes down. Your A1C comes down. Blood vessels start to become more elastic. Atherosclerosis goes down. High cholesterol comes down. Hypertension comes down. A number of things move in the right direction. So you see this story unfold over and over and over again. But yet somehow people in the world of autoimmune diabetes, type 1 and type 1.5, think that low-fat plant-based whole food nutrition doesn't apply to them. But what they don't realize is that even though a low-carbohydrate diet, which is a sort of general prescription that most people around the world are given,
right,
even though that will help you control your blood glucose with precision, especially if you're doing like a ketogenic diet as an example, where your carbohydrate intake is very, very low, you'll see people all around the world with their continuous glucose monitor profiles showing literally a flatline blood glucose all throughout the day. And they'll think, I solved the problem. Everything's going great. But what they don't realize is that by eating a low-carbohydrate diet, they're actually eating themselves into more insulin resistance.
So our energy comes from only three different places, right?
Correct.
So just tease that out for us.
For
sure.
Because
what you're saying is if it's low-carb, what's gone up to replace your carb as an energy source?
Very good. So you got basically carbohydrate, fat, and protein. These are your three energy sources. These are your three macronutrients. And so if you're eating a low-carbohydrate diet, that means de facto you've reduced your carbohydrate intake, which means that your protein and your fat intake go up to compensate.
What does that do for the body for diabetes? Obviously, for the sugars, you're getting a good flat line.
That's right.
But what does it do for yourself?
Okay. So the story of insulin resistance is actually fascinating. So what happens is that suppose you just start eating a low-carbohydrate diet today. What that means is that the predominant macronutrients that are going into your mouth are fat and protein, and you've got a limited supply of carbohydrate. So every single time you open your mouth, you're eating foods that are high in fat and high in protein, whether it's animal-based products, meat, cheese, fish. It could be plant-based products like olive oil, it could be avocados, nuts, and seeds, you name it. When your supply of fatty acids and protein are generally high, the fatty acids come in your mouth, they travel down your esophagus, they get inside of your small intestine, they're then transferred to your lymph system, then they're transferred to your blood. These fatty acids start circulating in your blood. Fatty acids can gain access to any tissue they want in your body. There's very weak mechanisms to prevent them from coming in. So under normal circumstances, it would be perfect if those fatty acids went right into your adipose tissue, your fat tissue, and stayed there. Because your adipose tissue is effectively a protective tissue, and it's designed to basically expand when there's fatty acids available, and then contract when those fatty acids are not available.
So it makes us warm, cuddly, and we look better with a little fat.
With just a little bit of fat.
Just a little bit. But so most people don't want it to go straight to their fat layer, though.
Yeah, most people don't want it to go to your fat layer. But
they don't realize the option.
Exactly. From a biological perspective, it's actually more beneficial to put dietary fatty acids into your adipose tissue because it's protective. It prevents other tissues from absorbing those fatty acids.
And what's the danger there?
Okay, so when your adipose tissue will absorb some of those fatty acids, but some of those fatty acids will also end up in your muscle tissue, in your quadriceps, in your chest, in your shoulders, in your triceps, your biceps, you name it. And they'll also get inside of your liver. And those tissues are designed to store small amounts of fatty acids. But over the course of time, as you eat more and more fat, the fat storage inside of your muscle and liver starts to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. And it gets to this critical mass, at which point the cells go into an insulin-resistant state. An insulin-resistant state is basically a self-protective state where these cells are trying to block more energy from coming in. So what they do, they can't really block fatty acids that well. So they shut down insulin signaling. And they say, if we tell the insulin receptors to not do a very good job, then we can block glucose. Let's keep glucose out of here. So then when you go eat a banana, the banana breaks down into glucose molecules. Glucose molecules circulate. Insulin knocks on the door and says, hey, I got this glucose. Would you like to take it up? And the muscle and liver look at you and they say, there's no way. Do you see all these fatty acids that I've stored over time? I got to get rid of this stuff first. There's no way I can take it. So it says, thanks, but no thanks. So the insulin and glucose, they get trapped inside of your blood.
So they're just going to circulate and do their damage because they're in the wrong place.
They're in the wrong place. They're trapped in a location where they're not supposed to be for extended periods of time.
Right.
So then you eat a banana. 2 hours later, you check your blood glucose. You look at your blood glucose meter and you go, huh, that's a high number. It's a 250. It's a 280. It's a 320. I guess the banana is the problem. And that's what people do over and over and over again. Every time I eat a high carbohydrate food, my blood glucose goes high. Therefore, the high carbohydrate food is the problem. But in reality, it's not the high carbohydrate food that caused the problem. It's everything that you ate before that high carbohydrate food that set the stage for that high carbohydrate food to not be effectively metabolized.
Before we hear more about this metabolic dysfunction in the next segment, there's another kind of dysfunction that you might want to think about too. America is considered fundamentally Christian, but is that still true today? Pew Research has found 80% say they believe in God, but only 56% believe in the God described in the Bible. The other 23% believe in another higher power or a spiritual force. Our time was prophesied in 2 Timothy 3, where God says that in the last days, people will be focused on themselves and money, they'll be unloving and unforgiving, they'll slander others and betray their friends, they'll lack self-control, put pleasure before God, they will act religious, but deny God's power. That's an apt description of the times in which we live. That means Jesus must be coming soon. The rest of the passage tells us to remain faithful to what we've learned in Scripture. That's where we find wisdom, to receive salvation by faith in Jesus. The Scriptures teach us how to decide right from wrong and equip us for ministry. So let's be diligent, daily students of the Scriptures. If you're struggling with high glucose or high cholesterol, work it down right now with Sean as he puts us through our paces. So what cholesterol busters have you got for us today?
That's a good one. I like that today. So we have some dumbbells today. Strength training, you know it's a great way for us to work our cardio, work on our toning of our muscles, challenge us in various ways. Today we have some exercises that are a little bit different from the norm. I'm going to show you some variations to challenge yourself depending where you are in your fitness level, okay? So let's get warmed up. Let's do a lateral lunge where our feet are nice and wide. And we're just going to go from the right side, come up to the left side. I promise you, this is not an exercise, it's more of a warm-up. So say it's an exercise. And not a warm-up.
If we're not doing many squats in our day, this is probably a
warm-up.
Yeah.
All right, there you go. Keep it going. Your goal here is to get this leg nice and straight, stretching your adductor muscles, which is right in the inside, and kind of just going as far as you can. What you may realize in terms of this exercise, look at that knee right there, okay? You don't want that knee to cave out too much, all right? So as you get warmer and warmer, you realize that you can go lower and lower, all right? So the warm-up is a great way to kind of see and gauge how you're feeling. Are you getting more warm, or is your flexibility improving as you go throughout the paces?
Right.
Okay. All right, so shake it out. Let's go grab these dumbbells.
Okay.
Exercise number one. Remember what it was?
No.
You don't?
No.
At all?
No.
Okay, so we're gonna go to our calf raises, okay? So imagine yourself here. We walk all throughout the day. And our calves stimulate us, or are stimulated a lot throughout the day. But what we're gonna do for these calf raises is we're gonna go all the way to the top, slow, steady, hold it, and come back down. Call it a three count, all right? One, two, three, hold it. One, two, three, come down. One, two, three, hold it. One, two, three, down. Again, because we walk all day and we're doing a lot of things going up and down steps, our calves really don't really react to some things that we do, especially if we do it faster, okay?
Right.
So with this, if you load that weight and you allow yourself to go a little bit slower, it will give you a much better contraction of the gastric meninges in the back, all right?
Right.
So take your time with these. Aim for about 15 of these, okay? Calves are very, very strong.
Yeah.
All right, in order for us to work our posterior chain, which is the back, we're gonna put our weight here. Hold it nice and strong. Core nice and tight, chest upright, and this is called a good morning, okay?
All right.
Come all the way down, get to about parallel. You'll feel the stretch in your glute. Don't go any further, and come right back up. Breathe. All the way back down, and come up. Now, in this exercise, what are you gonna feel, or what you should be feeling? Your lower back should never have any type of pain. It should feel like you feel nice and strong.
Mm-hmm.
You should feel a stretch in your glute, and you should also feel a little bit of a pulling in your hamstring, all right? Working the entire back region. At the same time, your core is doing a lot of work.
Mm.
You're putting a weight here and putting it further away from the core. Right, there you go. Come up, three, two, and one. From that position, we're gonna go into a shoulder press. Palms are gonna face each other, and you're gonna press straight up. There you go. Make sure you're breathing. Press, press, press. Shoulder press is a great exercise for us to improve our functional exercises when we are doing things on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
Picking up weights over our head is a great thing for us to do. Now, you could change it up. Palms facing forward. There you go. A different angle, a different way to stimulate your shoulder. Three, two, one. Now keep one arm down and the other one presses, and you keep on alternating. Another way to vary up how you stimulate your shoulders. Now use a weight that will challenge you. Aim for about 8 to 10. When you get to 10, it should be nice and challenging working your shoulder.
Yep.
Okay.
It is.
And three, two, and one. Three great exercises, all right? Remember, slow calf raises. Be nice and strong with the good mornings, come down to about 90 degrees, and vary up the intensity and how you stimulate the shoulders with the shoulder press.
Right. Okay?
There you go. Let's stretch it out. All right, feet nice and wide, and I want you to just relax your shoulder here. This is stretching your lower back, it's stretching your glute and your hamstrings from the good mornings. Okay, three, two, one, come up. Let's go on our right calf, get a good stretch. On your left calf, get a good stretch, and you are done.
Awesome. Thanks, Sean.
You're very welcome.
Trying to lower your cholesterol? Ordering a different sandwich for lunch might help. A 2009 UK study compared the effectiveness of two whole grains, wheat and rye, on lowering cholesterol levels. The study found that rye was more effective in lowering blood cholesterol levels. So when you are at the lunch counter next, ask for a lettuce and tomato sandwich on rye. This small change could make a big difference. Choosing whole grain rye bread is another ageless advantage.
I love getting your questions, and here are some for today. Here's our first question. I get nerve pains in my feet. What can I do to stop it? Well, if you have diabetes, this can be quite a serious sign of nerve damage, and it's important, really important, to control your sugars. The closer your sugars are to normal, the less the nerve damage happens and the slower it happens. So taking an antioxidant called alpha-lipoic acid can be helpful in that situation also. Next question. I'm an insulin-dependent diabetic. Does the insulin I take prevent me from losing weight? Well, the answer is yes, it can. It can make it harder to lose weight, but it won't prevent it completely. Insulin is essential for the life and health of people with type 1 diabetes, and some people who have type 2 diabetes, if their oral medication is not sufficient, over time their pancreas may fail and they too end up needing insulin. Or if they're just overweight and too insulin resistant, then we need to add in the insulin. And in that scenario, lifestyle change could really prolong the life of the pancreas or reduce the insulin resistance. So focusing on your weight is really important. Now, even though you might be on insulin, you can still reduce your dose if you lose weight, if you don't overeat, if you walk after your meals, then you can actually walk down your glucose rather than just relying on your insulin to bring it down. And so I recommend to all the people I see with diabetes that they walk for 10 to 15 minutes, not so they're out of breath, but and impairing digestion, but that they go for a gentle walk after meals just for 10 minutes, 5 minutes out, 5 minutes back, and then you can get on with whatever you were doing. So use up some of those calories that you just ate, and then shift your calories more to the morning rather than having them all in the evening. Have a very light supper, and then don't drink any calories or even sodas, actually, even the artificially sweetened, because that will still change your metabolism because they feed the bacteria, which is part of your metabolic process. So only drink water, no juice, no soda, and you may find that you can reduce your insulin. That will really help to shed the weight. And then here's our next question. Someone called in, does sugar make diabetes worse? Well, of course it does. Sugar definitely makes diabetes worse, but don't be only focused on the sugar, because so does fat. And so overeating, excess calories of any kind, insufficient fiber, and a sedentary lifestyle all contribute to the problem of diabetes. So lots of things that you can do apart from just avoiding the sugar. There are lots of other things you need to do. Now, if you want to send in your question, remember, you can contact us by website, email, text, or phone. And now let's head down to the store to see what's on offer. Unlike its name suggests, buckwheat is neither a cereal nor a wheat. But it's so named because its seed closely resembles the seed of the beech tree, and it's been cultivated as a grain since time immemorial. Thus the name beech wheat or buckwheat. It's grown all over the world as a short season crop. It smothers out weeds very effectively, and its flowers contain nectar that bees use to make rich amber honey. Then, once the flowers have yielded these buckwheat groats, the plant stalks can be used for straw or tilled in to help the next year's soil. Buckwheat has more zinc, copper, and manganese than most other cereals and provides a very high level of protein. And its high soluble fiber content helps to slow glucose absorption from a meal, so it's great for diabetes and pre-diabetes. And its moderate amount of resistant starch is also a plus for colon health. Buckwheat contains flavonoid compounds like rutin. They're helpful in preventing hypertension, inflammation, and cancer. I like to sprout buckwheat and then dehydrate it into a crunchy, nutty, low-fat snack that's just magic when it's combined with raisins. Or I soak it overnight with plenty of water, a little salt and vanilla, and cook it into some wonderful breakfast waffles. Bon appetit! Dr. Cyrus Kambada has a PhD in nutritional biochemistry and helps people gain the mastery over diabetes. A low-carb diet is often recommended for diabetics, but that means extra fat and protein in the diet. We already touched on the problem of extra fat, but here Dr. Kambada explains the impact of extra protein.
Protein can cause a number of metabolic problems down the road. When you're consuming protein, especially if it comes from animal sources, your IGF-1 level starts to increase. Now, IGF-1 is a molecule that's manufactured by your liver, And as IGF-1 increases, it stands for insulin-like growth factor 1. And just like insulin, that's a very potent growth signal. IGF-1 is a very potent growth signal. So when your IGF-1 levels start to increase, then tissues all throughout your body start to grow. They start to make more DNA, make more fatty acids, make more phospholipids. They start to replicate. So tissues actually start to grow over time, which is not necessarily a good thing, because one thing that can happen is it can actually accelerate tumor growth. So cells, as they're sort of replicating, they make replication errors in DNA. And if those replication errors are not corrected, and cells continue to propagate with DNA errors, they can eventually become cancerous cells. Those cancerous cells can then propagate into tumors, and your risk for cancer can go up over time. So evidence-based research has shown that people who have higher IGF-1 levels end up with an advanced risk for the development of cancer, number one. Number two, when you consume large amounts of protein, especially from animal sources, it puts a load on your kidney, on both of your kidneys. So your kidneys can actually start to become inflamed. They can actually start to produce acid inside of them. Okay, and so you end up with an acidic state, which then progresses to the same mechanism that causes atherosclerosis inside of your blood vessels, that harden your blood vessels. The same processes occur inside of your kidneys. And as a result of that, kidney filtration rate goes way down. You become much more susceptible to chronic kidney disease over time. And then that can result in you needing dialysis down the road.
So that's a recognized complication of diabetes. So you're speeding that process up.
Absolutely.
By doing the low-carb, high-protein, high-fat type diet.
Absolutely.
And so you've got this glucose and this insulin circulating. You've got damage happening to end organs. And that is just going to be a vicious cycle.
It's going to be a vicious cycle. And, you know, when it comes to diabetes complications, there's a whole collection of them. It could be retinopathy in your eyes. It can be neuropathy in your nerves. It can be kidney damage, fatty liver, atherosclerosis, heart disease, coronary artery disease. The list goes on. And most people living with diabetes make the assumption that because they have diabetes, they will get complications over time. That complications are inevitable and they're going to happen. It's just a question of whether those complications start 2 years from now or 30 years from now. But the truth is, complications do not have to happen. And complications are a result of the food you put in your mouth, not necessarily a result of just having diabetes unto itself.
So that's really good news for someone like yourself, diagnosed with type 1 diabetes early on in life. You've got a whole lifetime ahead of you. So to know that complications are not inevitable is really a hopeful message.
It's a very hopeful message, especially for people who are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at a young age. Because like we talked about earlier, they're sort of preconditioned to believe that a low carbohydrate diet is the best way and the only way. But in reality, that actually accelerates the development of diabetes complications.
So let's flip that. What happens with a plant-based, whole food plant-based diet?
Very good question. So when you're eating a low-fat plant-based whole food diet, this problem of insulin resistance, which is over-accumulation of excess fatty acids inside of your muscle and liver, those fatty acids get an opportunity to get oxidized for the first time in a long time. So those fatty acid stores actually become smaller over time, and this happens relatively rapidly. You could be eating a low-carbohydrate diet for 20 years, and you transition to a low-fat, plant-based, whole food diet. Those fatty acid stores can start to get chipped away within weeks to months. As a result of that, tissues become more responsive to glucose. So when you go eat a banana, a potato, a bowl of quinoa, the glucose molecules that are circulating in your blood can gain access to tissues for less insulin. So a little bit of insulin used to be ineffective, and now a little bit of insulin does a really good job.
And so it gets glucose even in your tissue. Type 1 diabetes.
Yeah, absolutely, for type 1 diabetes. So for patients who are living with type 1 diabetes like myself, insulin needs get cut significantly following a low-fat plant-based whole food diet. And most people don't believe this to be true. They say there's no way, because a plant-based diet is high in carbohydrate. Especially if you're eating fruits and potatoes and starches and rice and corn, right? Those are carbohydrate-rich foods. So
Absolutely.
If you're eating more carbohydrate, then you're going to need more insulin. But what's actually true is that the amount of insulin you need is not only dependent on the amount of carbohydrate going in your mouth. It's not a single variable relationship. There are multiple variables, and the other variable that very few people talk about is the total quantity of dietary fat. So in a high-fat context, in a high-fat environment, eating carbohydrate-rich foods becomes very challenging. In a low-fat environment, then eating carbohydrate becomes much more doable and much more metabolizable.
So in a whole food plant-based diet, what are your carbohydrate-rich foods?
Carbohydrate-rich foods include fruits of all kinds. These are things like berries that are low glycemic, as well as things like, you know, pineapple and watermelon and bananas that tend to be a little bit higher on the glycemic index. It also includes starchy vegetables like potatoes, sweet potatoes, corn, squash, turnips, parsnips, rutabaga, things that grow in the ground. It also includes non-starchy vegetables and then whole grains, whether those whole grains are rice, quinoa, millet, sorghum, you name it. So those are the predominant carbohydrate sources, and they also come prepackaged with a large quantity of micronutrients, which is absolutely necessary for total body health.
And total body health is what we want you to have, so stay with us. When today's guest, Cyrus, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, he was already dealing with other health issues. Watch.
I was nervous about doing any form of exercise. You know, I've been an athlete my whole life. I've played soccer, I've played baseball, I've played basketball, I swim, I run, I go to the gym, and I love using my body. I absolutely love it. And so to get diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and then have to limit the amount of activity I performed and really have to control my movement because I was injecting insulin and be very systematic about it, it didn't feel right at all. So now that I've adopted a low-fat, plant-based, whole food diet, my world is completely different in 1,000 ways. And one of the things that I love so much about this lifestyle is that eating a very nutrient-dense diet has enabled my body to feel totally different from the inside out. So not only is my glucose controlled in ways that I never predicted would happen, but when I go and I exercise now, I can usually push harder, I can push for a longer period of time, and the best part about it is that I can recover way faster than I ever used to be able to. Adopting a plant-based diet and really getting to a point where your blood glucose control is so good that, you know, I'm not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but I feel so confident in my ability to control my blood glucose that now I can exercise without any fear. And I can exercise as much as I want to, and that makes me feel like $1 million.
A far cry from feeling wretched on the low-carb diet. So I asked Dr. Kambata about his favorite food group.
Legumes are some of my favorite foods on the planet. Legumes are some of the most nutrient-dense foods that we've ever discovered. So they tend to have about equal amounts of carbohydrate and protein and are very low in fat. And on top of that, they have a giant collection of vitamins, minerals, fiber, antioxidants, and phytochemicals. And when you're constantly consuming legumes, whether it's beans, peas, lentils, these foods have such a high micronutrient density that they effectively bathe tissues in a collection of micronutrients that are floating in your blood.
Fertilizer,
that's a great way to think about it. And another thing that's actually really good specifically for people with diabetes, Dr. Joel Furman has actually brought this to my attention. And he shows you that there's this thing called a second meal effect, which is that if you eat legumes today for lunch, those legumes will help keep your blood glucose regulated in the post-lunch state, which is a good thing. But then in the second meal, the very next meal for dinner, most people find that their blood glucose is more controllable as a result of having legumes at the previous meal, because those legumes are acting over multiple meals. So you get the first meal effect and the second meal effect. And a lot of that has to do with the way that they interact with your gut microbiome.
You mentioned the microbiome. This is really important for glucose control, for absorption of nutrients and all kinds of things, right?
100%.
So Talk about the artificial sweeteners. I think a lot of diabetics use artificial sweeteners, but this comes into the microbiome story too.
Absolutely, yeah. So when your microbiome is sort of in an inflammatory state, okay, your microbiome is a collection of trillions of bacteria. I read a statistic once which blew my mind, and it said that you are only 10% human, right?
Yes.
Of all the cells, human cells in your body, there's 9 times or 10 times as many bacterial cells in your large intestine, actually all throughout your body. And most of those are housed in your large intestine. And that's a crazy number because there's something like 10 trillion bacterial cells in your large intestine, and they have a very specific purpose. And that is to metabolize a lot of the food that has been, that has escaped absorption and digestion through your small intestine. So your small intestine dumps into your large intestine, and then the leftover that you and I think is now garbage is going to go into the trash can is actually food for your microbiome. So what your microbiome does is it's constantly scavenging this collection of nutrients, and it's picking out nutrients to feed itself, and then as it gets a particular collection of nutrients, the microbiome can actually replicate. So bacterial cells will replicate and make more of themselves, right? So there's a whole collection of fiber-eating bacteria. There's thousands of different species that are known to be, fiber-eating bacteria. When they consume fiber, they end up creating these things called short-chain fatty acids, and these short-chain fatty acids can then circulate in your blood, and they can help boost immune function.
Many diabetics say, I can have soda. I use artificially sweetened soda. It's got no calories in it. But there's a problem with that, right?
Absolutely. There's huge problems with that. Artificial sweeteners, even though they're not canonical sort of table sugar, can still cause significant metabolic issues, and they can also they can play tricks with your brain. So one of the things that we've noticed is that when people add artificial sweeteners to their food, like stevia as an example, they say to themselves, oh, well, stevia doesn't contain calories, and therefore it's a better sweetener for me. In reality,
and it's natural.
And it's natural. It comes from a plant.
Plant,
right?
Yeah.
In reality, what it's doing is it's tricking their brain into expecting a very, very, very sweet flavor every single time they put food into their mouth. So their tongue gets desensitized to sweet flavors that come from natural food. Okay? They're constantly getting these incredibly sweet flavors and can no longer taste things that are designed to be sweet because they're not sweet enough. So their tongue gets desensitized. It sends a reward signal up to their brain that says, oh, that was tasty, give me more, give me more, give me more. So there's more serotonin and dopamine production, which happens in the brain, which regulates
addiction.
This process.
Right.
Exactly.
Yep, addiction.
So even though there's no calories in that, and even though the technique comes from a plant, I guess it's a better alternative. However, they tend to eat more food, they tend to overconsume on calories, and then when they go and actually eat real food, it doesn't taste good. The nice thing is that it's a reversible process, because if you reduce the amount of artificial sweeteners in your food, then normal food starts to taste starts to taste good. Exercise is one of my favorite topics because it's a very powerful insulin sensitizer. In other words, it will allow insulin to work more effectively in your body, and it'll bring your blood glucose down during the exercise regimen as well as right afterwards. And so what we generally recommend for our patients living with diabetes, regardless of the type of diabetes you're living with, is to move your body for approximately at least half an hour per day, 6 days a week. So you can say, okay, that's about 180 minutes for the course of a week, right? And that would be your minimum requirement. And when I say exercise, I don't necessarily mean just going and walking around the block. If there's some physical limitations that are preventing you from doing more, that's okay. But when I say exercise, I mean sweating, okay? Whether that could be things like jogging, hiking, biking, playing basketball, playing soccer, going to the gym, swimming, doing resistance exercise. Something that is significantly challenging enough that it forces you to sweat and it forces you to breathe hard. One thing I like to tell people is I say, okay, when you're exercising, if I were to call you on the phone, would you be able to have a phone conversation with me? If the answer is yes, that means you're not exercising, right? Can you sing your favorite song? If the answer is yes, you're not exercising, right? Should be significantly out of breath. Now, if you can do that for approximately half an hour or maybe a little bit more every single day, then every day you're getting insulin sensitized. Not only are you getting insulin sensitized right there during that period, but there's an afterburn effect. And so for the next 23 hours, tissues your muscle tissue, your liver tissue becomes hungrier and hungrier for glucose. So the next time you go eat something carbohydrate rich, that glucose gets sucked right into tissues and your blood glucose doesn't budge. So we see this over and over again with people as they, you know, develop an exercise regimen and to a certain extent get addicted to movement, which is a great thing.
Yes.
Then, you know, a low-fat, plant-based, whole-food diet on top of exercise gives you a double whammy, and that really takes your whole diabetes health to the next level.
And if you have diabetes, you can do the same. Just focus on keeping your fat intake low and eat a wide variety of unrefined foods, fruits and veggies, legumes and whole grains. Eliminate animal products such as meat, dairy and eggs. Spend half an hour a day working up a sweat and you will have mastered your diabetes. For more information on Cyrus, go to his website masteringdiabetes.org. That's all for me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.